Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Dr. Lerone Martin, an assistant professor of religion and politics at the John C. Danforth Center on Religion and Politics at Washington University in St. Louis. He was hired on the faculty after a one-year postdoctoral fellowship with the center, so all you young scholars out there, postdocs can do you good. Professor Martin earned his bachelor's degree from Anderson University in Anderson, Indiana, his Master of Divinity degree from Princeton Theological Seminary, and then went on to complete a PhD at Emory University in 2011. From 2010 to 2013, Lerone was an assistant professor of American Religious History and Culture at Eden Theological Seminary in St. Louis, where he taught courses in American and African American religious history. Dr. Martin has received fellowships from the Louisville Institute for the Study of American Religion, Emory University's Howard Hughes Medical Institute, the Fund for Theological Education, Princeton University's Center for African American Studies, and just recently from the American Council of Learned Societies. Ooh, that is a long and prestigious list. In 2014, Martin was selected for the Young Scholars in American Religion 2014-16 cohort as one of the top 10 pre-tenure scholars in American religion by the Center for the Study of Religion and American Culture at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. He currently chairs the American Academy of Religion's Committee on Teaching and Learning and serves on the AAR's Afro-American Religious History Group as well. He is the author of the book Preaching on Wax, The Phonograph and the Shaping of Modern African-American Religion, published by NYU Press, and is working on a manuscript on religious preachers and their relationship to the FBI. We will examine his published book today, and we'll link to it on our website, as well as some of the links to the audio clips that we will be talking about today. Like our other guests from the Danforth Center last week, Professor Martin has appeared on or written for a number of different media outlets, including CNN, Religion Dispatches, Charisma, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. But now he tops all of that off with his first appearance on our podcast. Lerone, welcome to Research on Religion.
Hi, Tony. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really, really excited to join you and looking forward to talking a little bit about the book.
Yeah, this is a really great book. Our podcast has been around for about 6 years now, and we tend to cover some pretty regular topics over time, such as issues related to religious liberty, or perhaps surveys on what various religious folks are believing or not believing. But I have to admit that my favorite episodes happen to be the ones that I wouldn't even expect would be topics of inquiry, and your work actually fits that category. You've written a book that deals with how the phonograph and those vinyl discs that they play shaped the African-American landscape in the 20th century, which is a really cool topic that I honestly would have never thought to think about. So how did you come to this topic?
It's a great question. I was raised in a religious home religious broadcasting was very, very, very present, almost ubiquitous. And so I think being raised in that context, as I went off to school, both undergraduate, and then when I decided to go to seminary, I became extremely curious about how this experience came about, how did sort of this experience of African-American preachers being so seemingly ubiquitous on in broadcasting. And as I began to study and decide to pursue a PhD and began looking through various books and histories, I didn't quite see the history of where this experience for African Americans sort of emerged. I saw a little bit about radio, but that was like in the 30s and 40s. So I was wondering if there was anything before that in the 20s. And I kind of stumbled upon the fact that there was a whole tradition of preachers who had gotten record deals from major labels to record and sell their sermons, and that's kind of how the story took off. So there's somewhat of a personal connection here, trying to kind of understand my own background and how I was raised.
Now, when you grew up in that household, did you hear a lot of these religious broadcasts on the radio, or did you have actually some of these phonographs, or I don't know, they might have been on CDs. You're a pretty young guy, so I don't know if you've had vinyl discs or not.
They were primarily television, radio, and cassettes and CDs.
Okay, all right.
That was the kind of the major format. Lots of tapes, and then of course, you know, CDs emerged as well during my childhood and late teens, and so that was the next sort of step in the progression.
Okay. Yeah, I have to admit, I'm a vinyl guy. I'm a bit older than you, and so I love vinyl. I don't like vinyl because of it sounds good or anything like that, but it's just what I grew up with, and I still have the very first album that I actually ever received, and so I kind of harken back to that era. So this topic also resonates with me, and I think it's really cool. Let me ask you this. When you started pursuing this project, and I assume that you did this at Emory as your graduate dissertation, correct?
Yes, sir, I did.
What did some of your advisors say when you approached them with this? They say, I want to study the phonograph. Did they go, nobody studies the phonograph. What are you doing?
You know, thankfully, I had really great support. Gary Latterman was my advisor, and he was very supportive, and as were the other people on my dissertation committee, Diane Stewart, Wallace Best at Princeton University, and Earl Lewis, who was no longer at Emory, who's now the president of the Mellon Foundation. I had a great support. I think they were surprised, and then as I presented them with evidence, all of them were supportive and were helpful for me as a graduate student. I think I was so caught up in the phenomenon that I just kind of wanted to tell the story of the phenomenon in my dissertation. Just tell it as a descriptive way. All of them were helpful in the process moving forward of helping me understand what the significance was, about what this meant for both religion in the 1920s, and even thinking about how this history is sort of come to bear in our current time.
Yeah, it is very cool, and it's a very well-written book because it tells that story. And I want, you know, encourage graduate students who are listening to this that if you get passionate about a story, you know, follow that path, because there's probably something there and you can turn it into lessons. And I know a lot of people would probably, you know, they think that scholarship has to deal with, you know, major topics of this and that and things, but it's actually these little things in everyday life that actually do have major impact. And so what you do is take this everyday story of the phonograph and these vinyl discs and really bring them to life, to their bigger significance. So again, I want to point everybody to this book because it is a really fun read, and it you write really well too. So
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, it's storytelling, and I love storytelling. And you begin the book in Georgia in 1926 with the story of Reverend James M. Gates, who's boarding a train in New York City for a month-long preaching tour. But more importantly, he's going there to record his sermons on a phonographic record at Columbia Studios. Now, you note that the first release of his album of sermons sold over 50,000 copies in just a few months. Now, by today's standards, that doesn't seem like anything. You know, we're talking millions of albums being sold and things like that. But 50,000 records was a huge accomplishment at that time. So give us a little bit of background on Reverend Gates and how he came to be picked up by Columbia Records and why he was able to sell so many copies.
Reverend Gates is a phenomenal historical actor, and that's kind of what really got me involved in writing and telling this story. Gates is born in the late 19th century in Hogansville, Georgia, and he is a preacher. He migrates to Atlanta in 1913 and starts a church and begins preaching and becomes sort of a local a local entity in terms of he's known as a good preacher locally in Atlanta, and he's known as a good preacher in kind of the old, what would have been considered a folk style or the call and response type of a sermon, where his sermons were sort of preached to a cadence. He had a sort of a musicality to his sermons, and he would welcome the call and response from the congregation, or the congregation's shouting amen and preach it, and things of this nature. He stuck to that style even when he moved to Atlanta and became well known for that style, as opposed to the style of preaching that was more staid or educated, that was becoming more of a trend within the African-American religious experience. People like Martin Luther King's father talked about in his autobiography about when he came to Atlanta, about how he changed his preaching style to appear more urbane and more sort of educated. But Gates stuck to that style, and as a result of that, was discovered by a local talent scout, what we would call today an A&R, artist and repertoire person, from Columbia Records. And he's invited to record for the first time in 1926, against the backdrop of record labels beginning to record sermons. And so Reverend Gates records for the first time in 1926, and the records begin to sell extremely well. The records are priced at 75 cents a record. Usually there is a sermon on one side and a song on the other, or part one of a sermon on the first side and the second half of the sermon on the other side. These are 78s, so we're talking about, for the most part, 3 to 4 minutes. So you're getting about 8 minutes of preaching, which is pretty quick. But it kind of, what Gates did so well was that he was able to recreate in that 8 minutes a Protestant sort of evangelical worship service that included shouting and usually a call to the altar for salvation. And these records sell extremely well. 50,000 copies today, obviously with the expansion of consumer culture and the expansion of just the American population, doesn't seem like a lot. But in the time, in the 1920s, what most record scholars and phonograph scholars and the music business scholars will say is that we could roughly say anything that sells about 10 to 15,000 records at the time would be close to what we would say today as a gold album. So anything above 15,000 would be almost the equivalent at that time to what we would consider a gold album today, which is about 500,000 records. So when Gates sold about 50,000, this would be sort of a close analogy to sort of something going platinum or selling 1 million records, given the size of America's consumer culture. So Gates is a huge success, and his career takes off from there. And this is kind of the story that got me involved in writing the dissertation and later the book, and then sort of expanding out from there. It's a great story. I wanted to find more about Reverend Gates, but he did not have any children. He adopted a daughter, but the daughter did not take his last name, and then she, I'm sure, eventually was married, and so I was unable to track her down. I was able to track down Reverend Gates' church in Atlanta, which has since moved, but it's still there, and they didn't have much about Reverend Gates either, but they were very welcoming to me. They knew his name. They knew he had been a part of their church, but they didn't know much about him, so they welcomed my presence there, and I actually helped them to sort of discover more about Reverend Gates and being there and studying there, so that was also fun.
Oh, yeah, that is very cool. It kind of adds a little bit to the historical intrigue of this, I guess, that there isn't much of a record, but we have this snapshot or a phonograph of his preaching and his voice at that time, and it's just, reading your book, it's like looking into a window that it's, you don't know what's necessarily around it, but you can see a little bit of slice of what life was back then. And we're going to listen to some of the clips a little bit later in the podcast to give folks a flavor of that. But what I would like to do right now, and we're going to come back to Reverend Gates here in a little bit, I want you to talk about the general religious and social landscape of the time. Your book is framed around when the phonograph is becoming a major new source of media, which is largely the early to mid 20th century, maybe the 1920s to 1940s or so.
So take us back, if you can, and perhaps even going back to around the turn of the century, and give us a sense of what is happening historically to the African-American community, both socially and religiously.
Yeah, Reverend Gates and the other preachers who preach on wax, their phenomenon is sort of wrapped up within the Great Migration. This is the term used to talk about the urban migration of African-Americans, which begins at the turn of the century. Some would even date it back even in the late 19th century, when African-Americans move in large numbers from rural America, which is where the largely the African-American population was concentrated in rural America, almost 90% of the African-American population in the 1890 census is found in rural America, to moving to urban America in large numbers, and not just the urban north, which is important, where a large number of African-Americans go, Chicago, New York City, Detroit, Cleveland, but also the urban south. So you start getting black populations swelling in places like Atlanta and Memphis, and other places of that nature in the urban south. So this changes a great deal when you have a group of people who are used to rural environments moving to the urban, moving into urban environments. This involves everything from education, obviously, to religion, to economics, to labor. So the African-American life is changing drastically. And, of course, in the midst of all that, we have World War One as well, which is also changing America writ large. So this is kind of the move that Reverend Gates and these other preachers are involved in. As it relates to religion and education, you have a rise of what, during this time, of what scholars have called the rise of the New Negro. And this is sort of the first generation or an educated cadre of African-American college graduates, attorneys, white-collar professionals growing in large numbers. And this, of course, shifts sort of the expectations and ideas that occur within African-American religious communities as it relates to expecting preachers to have more of sort of a scholarly discourse in their sermons, what African-Americans are expecting from their churches and from African-American leadership. But then at the same time, you have, during this cadre of the New Negro of African-American professionals, you still have a large number of African-Americans coming from rural areas who are still part of the laboring classes and who are still accustomed and still used to a worship experience that is not staid. That is, the teaching in the churches is not didactic in a way that it's much more of a religion that is evangelical, it's experiential, it's about having the Spirit move upon individuals and within the church. And this sort of brings about what I say in the book about two different kind of religious experiences, where we have sort of that of the black literati, those the educated class of folks, but also this sort of laboring class of folks who have their own worship experience that's more classed as sort of the folk worship experience, where call and response is expected during the sermon. You have much more of an experiential worship service there in terms of dancing, or what people would call shouting, experiencing salvation in the Holy Spirit. So these two sorts of trends are occurring within African American life during this time as a result of the Great Migration. And preaching on wax, these sermons, are a way in which to continue this sort of expressive worship style and to commodify it and monetize it in the emergence of modern America.
Yeah, it fits in really well. One thing I want to ask you about, you mentioned something about the Harlem Renaissance, and you mentioned this in the context of the black literati. Since a lot of the recording is going on at New York City at the time and Harlem's in that area, what is that Harlem Renaissance? What's going on there?
Thank you. That's a great question. It's an explosion of African-American cultural production. So both in terms of literature, we think about people like Langston Hughes, Elaine Locke, and these sorts of folks. Literature, poetry, jazz and blues in terms of music. And I want to include in that the explosion of these African-American recorded sermons, that this is happens at a time of again, just a proliferation of African-American cultural production in America. And often the scholarship has sort of focused mostly on the literature, people like Langston Hughes and others, the accomplishments in music with jazz and blues, but religion has kind of been left out of that conversation. And I think that these sermons are representative of African-American cultural production being a part of that Harlem Renaissance moment, even as it's sort of been forgotten about.
And one of the things you just mentioned was jazz and blues, and I can see how the recording industry lends itself to that. If you go into a, well, there are no record stores anymore, but if you go to iTunes, you know, most of it is music and things that you can listen to over repeatedly. To have sermons on there, the spoken word, although you're going to find out it's spoken word with a kind of a rhythm. There's almost a musical quality to a lot of these sermons is kind of interesting. For the folks that don't really know the history of the phonograph, and you do a nice job recounting this because I grew up in the 60s and I had one of those little portable things and I brought my albums out and that's what I thought it was. Tell us a little bit about this phonograph, because back in the 1920s, people are using this. How many people have this? What do they look like? Give us a history there.
The phonograph starts off in the late 19th century. And it's known as the gramophone at the time. And these are wax cylinders that Thomas Edison really helps to introduce into the market in the late 19th century. And this is the first time that Americans, and then of course around the world, are able to reproduce sound on demand. When Edison has his sort of exhibition in D.C., the reports are fascinating to read in newspapers. One newspaper account said that when Edison spoke into the gramophone and recorded himself laughing, talking, barking, doing all sorts of sounds for the audience to see the gramophone work, people were just completely amazed. One newspaper report says a woman just fainted. Another newspaper report says that the machine must have been possessed by an evil spirit, probably the devil. So there's all types of just amazement, astonishment. The president at the time, which was Rutherford B. Hayes, invited Edison to come by to the White House for kind of an evening party around the phonograph to sort of just talk with the machine. And sort of people were just really, really, really just fascinated by it, that they could record themselves and hear themselves speak again, and there could be their sound could be preserved for all time. So originally, from there, the phonograph is primarily a commercial amusement. It's there's placed in phonograph arcades. People can use about a nickel to hear a joke, a song, any type of just small amusement or recording amusement for recording purposes. And then from there, it begins to transition into a sort of home entertainment medium, which is aided by the transition of wax cylinders into flat disc, which sort of gets the name of the phonograph from there, and also the sort of the phonograph as we think about it as a piece of furniture, where it is enclosed in oak or mahogany, and it looks like a piece of furniture. And at the time, beginning in 1918, following World War One, if you look through newspaper advertisements, you'll see phonographs for sale for as cheap as $20 at the time, all the way up to $900, depending on the kind of oak or mahogany wood you wanted your phonograph enclosed in. So like televisions or computers, they had phonographs for every taste. And the expansion of it as a home sort of entertainment medium brought with it, of course, a host of selections one could purchase on the phonograph, from comedic talks, presidential candidates, which is extremely relevant at the current moment we live in, recorded advertisement records or campaign records that they would give out for free. There were spoken word and, of course, music. The reproduction of music becomes extremely popular. And from there, the phonograph really takes off, broadly speaking. The phonograph industry, largely because of racism, doesn't really record African Americans in the early days. There's some recording of the Fisk Jubilee singers who are singing old Negro spirituals and things of this nature, and even minstrelsy records. But recording for African Americans, by African Americans, again for the African American market, doesn't come until 1920, and that's with the emergence of race records. And this is the beginning of jazz and blues, and this begins with Mamie Smith in 1920 recording for OK Records, which was later bought by Columbia Records. And then 1920 is when we have the emergence of this phenomenon known as race records. These are jazz and blues records recording for African-American consumers. And the phonograph then takes off with an African-American life like never before. Even as the phonograph is slowly receding in the homes of urban whites, being replaced by radio, the phonograph is finding a new consumer market with African-Americans beginning in 1920.
Yeah, that's an absolutely fascinating story because, you know, we, in our modern day and age, we think of media kind of coming and going rather rapidly, but the radio comes in and really kind of replaces the phonograph as, it doesn't replace it, we still have it for a long time, but it's a competing medium for getting things across. One of the questions I had on the phonograph, and I'm just trying to, as I'm reading through your book, you mentioned that people would buy this in the African American communities, and they would oftentimes take it traveling. You know, they're on a train or something like that. Yeah. It must have been a small portable thing. I can't envision what one of these things looked like.
Yeah, some of them, according to the advertisements, were they, even thinking about places like chain stores, and Sears, JCPenney, Montgomery Ward. These are the size of suitcases. So you could, it'd be a size of a fairly decent sized suitcase, and people would fold them up and take them with them traveling. There are reports in Middletown, which is a great survey of the 1920s, sort of mid-sized city, which I believe is Muncie, Indiana. There's a report of a family vacation, taking the phonograph and putting it in the back seat, and so that in a world where radio is just sort of very young and not very dependable, people traveling with their phonographs in the back of their car so they can have entertainment as they drive cross country for a vacation. There's talks of people on the wealthier end having phonographs that are sort of built into the wall of their apartments in the 1920s. So people really wanted their phonographs in every single possible way that they could. And the more expensive machine you had, the better. There are reports of African-American jazz musicians talking about the phonograph being purchased and being placed in the window of their home in the 1920s as a sign of wealth, as a sign of, we have arrived, we're keeping up with the Joneses. And it was all based on the sort of the luxury and exclusive nature of one's phonograph. And so this, it becomes a device that is both for entertainment but also something that reflective of one's class standing or one's class aspirations.
Now, the battery technology, I don't think, was really well developed at this time. When you take these things in the back of a car or on a train or something, are these hand cranked?
These are hand cranked. Many of these are sort of, they have a little hand crank on the side. Exactly. You crank the phonograph on the side and it goes until you got to crank it again. That's especially in the South, which is one reason why, as radio is slowly climbing, but for many African-American surveys tell us in the South where electricity is not as widespread, the phonograph is so popular because you can still buy a winding phonograph on the side, that's hand cranked on the side, that you could use it whether you had electricity in your home or not.
You know, I can imagine just how this is going is when your kids start slowing down, not cranking as hard enough, and the music or the sound starts going, and you come on, crank harder, Bill, you know. I was just kind of just envisioning that in my head is kind of interesting. I also want to kind of get a sense, as you mentioned, there's electricity is not really widespread, and even though these things are priced in catalogs, it seems pretty cheap, $20. That's a lot of money at the time, especially for people in poor rural communities. How did this stuff get shared? Was there one family that bought these and then everybody came over to their house on a Friday night, or did they walk around with these things and say, hey, you got to hear what I just got? How do you have any kind of cultural knowledge of that?
I do. A lot of it was shared. It was about, you know, come over, we've got the latest phonograph record, come over to our house. And so it becomes like a family gathering. Mahalia Jackson, who's a well-known gospel singer, one of the gospel singers who sang at the March on Washington, she recalls growing up in New Orleans and Friday, everyone going to the local record store, pulling their money together to buy some of the newest records put out by Columbia or Paramount Records, and people going over various people's houses to listen to the new records, and word would spread like wildfire. Mrs. Johnson just purchased the brand new Bessie Smith album, or Mr. Jackson just purchased the brand new Reverend Gates sermon, and people would gather at one another's houses and sit around and listen to these things over and over and over again. They were also used for large social gatherings. It was people could pool their money together, go buy records, and have a dance party as opposed to hiring a live band. And so these phonographs are used for community gatherings as well. So they're used in all types of ways, and people are gathering around the phonograph for an evening of entertainment. And it's great stories to read about the excitement of people being excited, going to the record shop, all types of reports from Birmingham to New York City about people waiting in line, lines being wrapped around the block as people wait for the latest phonograph album, a record to come out, to purchase it, to share it. One story I think I may share in the book is salesman talks about people buying them, of course, for the latest romantic song, so that way they could show off to either their partner or someone they hope to make their partner, that they had the latest music, the latest song, the latest slow song or a romantic song or love song. That was a huge push. There's also reports in cities, Chicago, New York, where people are buying them and selling them, as we would say today, sort of bootleg, if you will, buying the record and then selling it for more in the local neighborhood. And then also reports of records being purchased in large numbers by sleeping car porters and other employees of the train industry. So men and women who work on the trains, as trains is a form of major travel in America in the 1920s, buying a bunch of records at wholesale in Chicago and New York, and then traveling throughout the country on various train routes and selling them to customers on the train as well. So these records are being sold in every way, from chain stores to door-to-door salesmen to sleeping car porter workers on trains. And so these networks are far and wide.
Such a cool history. We think of now just downloading music, but the way it spread before, just really cool. Now, you know, I mentioned this earlier that, you know, today we mostly associate our music downloads or CDs, however we get our music, usually with music. There's a few talking albums, you know, where people talk. I had a couple comedy albums when I was a kid, but after a while, the joke kind of goes stale, so to speak. And so it doesn't seem that like a sermon or, you know, a comedy album would be that popular. I guess if you're sharing it, though, it'd be different because you can pass that stuff around. But here's the question I had, is that why did folks start breaking into the religious sermon genre of phonographs? How did African American preachers get involved in this? You mentioned Gates started in 1926, but how did that all occur?
The first sermon is recorded in 1925 by a gentleman by the name of Calvin Dixon, and he takes the name after the famous white evangelist of the era, Billy Sunday. So he takes the recording name Black Billy Sunday. And he's discovered by Columbia Records. He's a well-known preacher in the Norfolk, Virginia area. He's extremely against commercial amusements, whether it be dancing, jazz, and blues. He's a Baptist preacher, and he's against these things. There are reports in the local newspaper that some African-American entertainment proprietors team up with the city fathers of the city of Norfolk and say, you know, like, this guy is holding these revivals. He's shaming our customers. We've got to come together and figure out how to get this guy out of here. So he becomes extremely popular in the Norfolk, Virginia area. At the same time, jazz and blues in America are still selling like wildfire, both in black communities and white communities. And Reverend Dixon is an example of a broader trend within African American faith communities that are concerned about the moral sort of influence of jazz and blues at the time, whether it's Bessie Smith singing about having sex outside of marriage, or if it's Ma Rainey singing about her purported same-sex relationships, or even just the advertisements of some of these jazz and blues, which sort of trafficked in African-American stereotypes. There's a great deal of concern. So there's a whole cadre of preachers who are thinking about how best to respond to jazz and blues. You look at African-American periodicals, there's all types of concern about what should African-Americans do. Reverend Dixon is an example of one African-American preachers who decide the best way to combat this influence is to actually join the record industry. It's not to just completely turn their backs on the record industry and say that we just won't be have any part of it. It's to actually join the record industry and make recordings that have a good moral influence. And that's, of course, going to be considered sermons. So Calvin Dixon is discovered preaching in Norfolk, Virginia because of his popularity there. A Columbia talent scout discovers him and invites him to New York to record. And this is announced in some of the more, well, popular phonograph magazines, the most prominent one being the Talking Machine World, announces that Reverend Calvin Dixon is going to be traveling to New York to record in January of 1925. And he travels to Columbia, and it looks as if, from the studio log, it looks as if, ironically, Bessie Smith was in the studio with Louis Armstrong right before him recording St. Louis Blues, which is a song about traveling to the major city where people have diamond rings and nice clothes and store-bought hair and things of this nature. They file out, Bessie Smith and Louis Armstrong leave, and the next person in the studio log, the recording ledger, is Calvin Dixon. And he comes into the studio and records a very staid sort of scholarly sermon called An Eagle Stirreth Her Nest. And he records this sermon, and it's about the Great Migration, African Americans moving to the city, in a response, in a way, to Bessie Smith not to engage in sort of being lost in consumerism and being lost in sort of the wilds of urban America, but that God has stirred the nest in order for African Americans to move to a higher plane of living and of spirituality. And that's the sermon that he preaches there in January of 1925. That's how the phenomenon got started, and as these records become extremely popular, other labels jump on board. Paramount Records begins to record African-American preachers, male and female. Other record labels, smaller labels, get involved as well. And eventually, chain store labels even get involved. Montgomery Ward and other labels get involved and try to get a piece of the pie as well as these records become extremely profitable.
Now, you gave me a couple clips that we wanted to listen to, and one of them was this first recording, An Eagle Stirs Her Nest, and the audio quality on it is a little bit poor, so I'm going to point people back to that, but we'll try to get some of these other ones spliced in here in a minute for you to listen to. So I encourage people to go multimedia, go to their computer, to the YouTube and places like that to find this out. I just, as you're telling the story, though, I have to think, you know, you had Betsy Page, or Bessie Smith there right before Calvin Dixon. Were the record music executives ever thinking, why are we letting Dixon in here? He's preaching against these blues and the jazz, and we're trying to sell jazz records. What's going on?
It seems that from the interviews that have been available, the UNC Southern History Archive has some great interviews with some of these early record producers and talent scouts and A&Rs. And it just seems to them that this was just about making money. This was just about, there's a market for jazz and blues, and there's a market for sermons, and sometimes those markets intersect. And I think they were just concerned about how best to make money. And I think their policy, it seems to be that if they could get a preacher or any artist, but a preacher for our purposes, to sell or to get orders of about 5,000 sermons, they would have considered that a moderate success. And 10,000 would be certainly a preacher would be invited back to the studio to record more. So it seems as if their major motivation was just to be able to sell records and to be able to make money. And most of these preachers, it seems, most of them signed contracts what were known as flat payments, where they would just get paid per sermon and not be connected in any way, shape, or form to any royalties. And so many of these preachers received a flat payment up front, anywhere between $50 to $150 per sermon at the time, which is roughly, we could say, would have the economic status of maybe, you know, $5,000 today per sermon. So they were paid pretty well, especially at a time in the 1920s when preacher's salaries were not competing at all whatsoever with other professionals. So I think the major concern was just making profit. What we can tell from Reverend Gates, from copyright filings at the Library of Congress, it seems as if Reverend Gates had a copyright agreement with most of the sermons and labels that he connected with. So it seems as if Reverend Gates probably collected royalties and anywhere, which would have been normal for the time, anywhere between 1 to 3 cents a copy, 1 to 3 cents royalties for every sermon that every record he sold, which is not too far off from the types of royalties we see today in the digital era with streaming and with purchasing digital music. Those royalty numbers aren't too far from what we see today.
Interesting. What about the composition of the folks doing this, the socioeconomic characteristics? Did we see a lot of rural pastors coming in to record? Were there some urban pastors? Were they specific denominations? Were they Baptist, Methodist? Were they coming from the Southeast? Or was there any action out in the West? I'm a West Coast guy, so I want to know if there's some action there. So what's kind of the socio-demographic makeup of this?
Most of these preachers are working-class preachers. Reverend Dixon or Black Billy Sunday seems to have had some education. His advertisements are very much so about how he's a scholarly preacher. He's an educated preacher. He's a race leader. But the record, the sermons that seem to have sold the most were actually from more of the kind of down-home, plain folk preachers. So people like Reverend Gates and others. So the demographic tended to be mostly Baptists and a few Pentecostal and holiness preachers. It seems as if that the folks, the Methodist, the AME African Methodist Episcopal or AME Zion, it seems that those preachers, particularly concentrated in urban areas and concerned about racial uplift, kind of stayed away from this form of commodifying the gospel. They saw it as antithetical to racial uplift and even antithetical to certain types of religious piety. So it seems that it was primarily Pentecostal holiness and Baptist preachers. A great example of this is Reverend Gates moves to Atlanta in 1913, as I say in the book, and Martin Luther King's father, Martin Luther King Sr., also arrived in Atlanta in 1913, both of them from rural Georgia. And both of them arrive in Atlanta they attend school, which basically gets them up to about close to a high school level of education. And then in 1926, Reverend Martin Luther King Sr. enrolls at Morehouse. He goes to Morehouse and takes religious studies courses, theology courses, and gets his B.A. At the same time, in 1926, Reverend Gates goes with Columbia Records to record his sermons. So it seems as if there were two different sort of tracks that I argue in the book, one of which was about gaining pastoral and cultural authority through education, whereas that's Martin Luther King Sr. does that, and preachers like Reverend Gates decided to gain their cultural authority and recognition via the marketplace. And that's sort of two different strands that I argue we still see today within American religion, particularly the Protestant experience.
When it comes to these sermons then, and you got these different tracks, you have the more highbrow education one, you have the more common folk one there on the wax. Are there any themes that come up in these recorded sermons that are consistent, or is it all across the board?
Well, consistent themes are personal piety. One of the other consistent themes is death and hell. These are a lot of these preachers are hellfire and brimstone. Some of them are. So Reverend Gates, one of his more popular, more of an altar call than it is an actual sermon, but it's called "Death's Black Train Is Coming." Reverend F. W. McGee had sermons dealing with hell. Other preachers had sermons dealing with, one preacher's sermon was called The Diamond Express Train to Hell. It was an 8-part series about the various stops that the Diamond Express train made on its way to hell, including Dance Hall Depot and Gambler's Row. So sermons included a great deal about personal piety and about hellfire and brimstone. And then Reverend Gates sort of branches out and begins sort of recording records that are almost similar to sort of the kind of comedic serial skits you would hear on radio, but he places them more in the church. So you'll have a skit about church members arguing about at Bible study on one side of a record and a sermon on the other about that very thing. So the consistent themes are the dangers of hell, personal piety, and of course, this is the 1920s, so personal piety includes prohibition. And there's a great deal about gender. There's a great deal about concerns about the 1920s. Women are voting. Women are flappers. They're blues singers. They're jazz singers. So there's a great deal about women breaking what would have been at the time considered gender norms and how that is an expression of a rebellion against God. So that's another theme that these preachers, many of them, were just unable to, they were focused on it within a way that comes up consistently. I'll say it that way.
Well, let's go ahead and take a listen to a couple of these clips here. And I want to start off, you provide me with a list of them, and we won't be able to get to all of them. So we'll link to a bunch of these. In fact, I want to link to some of those serial comedic skits, because it sounds like what goes on in my church every weekend, too. So I mean, it's just like, you know, somebody just had a secret microphone recording. I don't like the color of the carpet. The music is too loud, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But let's start off with one I thought was very interesting. Reverend F.W. McGee, Jonah in the Belly. So let's take a listen to that and then give us your take on it.
Dear sisters and brothers, our text is found today in the book of Jonah, in the first chapter and the 17th verse, and reads like this: Now the Lord had prepared a great fish to swallow up Jonah, and Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and 3 nights. Our subject is Jonah in the belly of the whale. I'll try to tell you how Brother Jonah got in the belly of the whale. The Lord had told Brother Jonah to go over to Nineveh and cry against that wicked city. But Brother Jonah, like many preachers today, wouldn't obey God. So he went down to Joppa and got a ship going to Tarshish. And while he was on that ship, the Lord moved. upon the water. And the sea got Kimbester. And the seamen got Fred. And they cast lots to see what was the matter. So they found out that Brother Jonah was in trouble. So Brother Jonah was down in the bottom of the ship. Went down there and got Brother Jonah out. And made him cry unto his God. Brother Jonah told them that the fault was in him. And he told them to cast him overboard. And the Lord had prepared a great fish. And they cast him over. And the ship swallowed him up. Amen. Don't be overboard.
Reverend F.W. McGee's sermon, Jonah in the Belly of the Whale. Again, it's a great sermon. F.W. McGee was a Pentecostal preacher. He's Church of God in Christ, actually becomes a bishop in the Church of God in Christ. And the sermon is a sort of a retelling about Jonah in the Belly of the Whale and what that even means for believers today, in his time in 1927, when he recorded that sermon. And it was popular. It was one of his more popular sermons. And he says in an interview years later, as he reflects on this moment, that when he got word how well his sermons were selling, again, this is 1920, so he's the 1920s, so he's, you know, doesn't have Facebook or a telephone or email to kind of know how well his records are selling. But once he gets word from people and the local record stores are sold out of his sermon, he says he demands a pay increase from the record label, and he gets it. He gets his pay increase, and he records for them all the way through getting up close to the outbreak of war in Europe. So F.W. McGee, this is one of his more popular sermons, and I think most people will recognize it for what it is, sort of the retelling of this story of Jonah in the belly of the whale and what that might mean for those who are trying to live a committed Christian life in 1927.
Another one we have here is by J.C. Burnett, and this is The Downfall of Nebuchadnezzar. So tell us a little, let's take a listen to it first, and then let's go ahead and give us a little indication of what is going on here. And if you could also talk a little bit about the style. You had mentioned, you know, before about the cadence being very important and all that. So how does that work in? Let's listen to it first.
I heard the voice of text this morning at the 14th chapter of Daniel and at the 4th verse. Words of the text. Thus hew down the tree. Subject, the downfall of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was the king of Babylon. and it rains all over the vicinity. And all nations tremble and fear before Nebuchadnezzar. But when his heart will lift it up in pride, my friend, God got angry with him. God sent a vision before him, my friend. And the prophet Daniel, one that interpreted. And when Daniel come before him, he said, oh, king, I'm sorry to tell you, but God of heaven put a place in your heart like a beast. And you're going out and nip grass 7 long years. When Nebuchadnezzar had went out and nip grass 7 long years, figured out, blowed out like boys flawed, like eagle fell. But I got wet with the dew of heaven. Lord, when some years had passed over his head, he lifted up his eye and declared to heaven to rule. Now, friend, let me tell you, God rules in the kingdom of men. And he can take the king up from whom to love he will and give it to anyone he want to give it to. Now, you liar. Now, you backslider. Now, you rich man. Let me tell you that God is able to bring you down. My friend, let me tell you one thing. If you desire to know the outcome of these calamities, you better get in touch with God right now. Amen.
Downfall of Nebuchadnezzar is probably, what we can tell, probably the highest-selling sermon of the era up until the outbreak of World War II. It looks like Columbia received orders up to about 90,000 for this sermon, which it was a quintessential example of the sort of chanted sermon or the folk style of the sermon. You can hear the congregation in the back. There's humming, there's singing, there's people encouraging him to keep preaching. And it's using the downfall of Nebuchadnezzar in the biblical story as an example about for believers to maintain a certain sense of humility before God, or they too would have a downfall. And the interesting thing of background about that sermon is that J.C. Burnett was from Kansas City, Missouri, and recorded for a small, privately owned record label named Merit Records. And Merit was very small, very tiny, and was basically printed records, copied records, basically on demand. And so for what I was able to discover, it seems as if J.C. Burnett had these sermons and was selling them basically out of the trunk of his car. He was selling them around as he would go on revivals. He was sort of a self-entrepreneur selling these things. Columbia, somehow, a talent scout in the Kansas City area, got wind of how popular some of his sermons were. And so they assigned him and asked him to record some of his sermons for Columbia Records. And, of course, they were a hit. And I saw in one newspaper that Merit Records, the owner of Merit Records, decided to sue J.C. Burnett for a breach of contract because he had signed a contract with Merit Records. But I searched all over Kansas City and the judicial court in Kansas City, the local courts, municipal courts, everything, and I could find no records of a lawsuit. So it appears that while he may have Merit Records intended maybe perhaps to sue, maybe perhaps Columbia just completely was just too powerful for him to even consider it. And J.C. Burnett records several more popular sermons for Columbia Records.
One of the other things that you do very nicely in your book is talk about the impact of these things outside of just the religious landscape. And you have a full chapter on social justice and how this impacted here with specific reference to chain store boycotts. So let's take a listen to Reverend Gates, who we mentioned earlier here in the podcast. He's preaching against chain stores right here. Let's listen to that and tell us what the impact that phonographic religion had on social movements at the time.
I think the password of this country should be of today, stay out of the chain store or goodbye chain store. I tell you, when I hear and see so much evil has been done through the chain store manner, I tell you, my people's particular, you just as well to open your eye and look on the field. Because it means to you, no job.
Yes.
Number one.
Yes.
Number two,
yes.
It means to you,
yes.
No credit.
Right.
You spend $100 a week.
Yes.
You get no credit. When you become sick, out of a job,
yes.
You get no credit.
Right.
And I'm thinking of a good old deacon of mine that used to spend his money in this church, but now he don't even attend the church. And I don't see him at all.
Yes, sir, I tell you the truth, Brother Pastor, the place I was working, as you see,
yeah.
The white folk went out of business.
Yeah.
Because the chain still right there.
Yeah.
And that's why you ain't been seeing me in the church.
Yeah.
And if things keep on like it is now, Brother Pastor, you won't see me soon.
Yeah.
But I hope it'll change.
Yeah. It'll never change so long as you stay in the chain store. But I want to tell you, this thing means to you.
Yeah.
What it meant to me when I cut the limb off between me and the tree.
Mm-hmm.
It meant a fall.
Yes,
and you're going to get a fall if you keep it up.
Yes.
You just as well to patronize the independent merchant,
yes.
Patronize the hometown merchant.
Yes.
Well, you have a reason.
Yes.
First reason is this.
Yes.
Who's going to credit you?
Yes.
Second reason, who's buying your mule for the country people?
Yes.
When they come to town, spend the cash money. Who's going to let you have a mule on the credit? Who's going to let you have a wagon on the credit? Who's going to let you have an automobile or help you to get one and let you pay for it when you can? Who's going to put up with the bold weevils eating up everything you're trying to make,
yes.
And then crediting you and feeding you? Is the chain so people's going to do it?
No.
No. They never have done it and never will.
Amen.
And so I see, Sister Bell, you, I don't see you now much.
Well, I don't know what.
I saw you with a bundle coming from some store.
Where you thought I was coming?
Chain store's what I thought.
Well, you must have thought it, not me. I trade right around the corner there with that man. It gives me my credit any time.
That's what you ought to do.
Oh, yes. If it rains and I can't carry in my clothes, I get my trade right on.
Mm-hmm.
And if I carry in my clothes and pay him off, it's just the same thing.
Yeah?
No, not me with chain stores.
I see.
No.
Well, you got good sense.
Amen.
And I'm thinking about Sister Judden, who's a good cook, said to be one of the best cooks. But I don't see her now at the job, and neither is she in the big house she used to live in.
Yeah, Brother Pastor, those people aren't cooking, but they're cooking for themselves now.
Yeah, yes, and that's it. A man that used to come by my home driving one of those big red trucks, he too used to boast about his job. But
yes.
The man that he's working for then is driving a little Ford,
yes.
And he's walking now.
Yes.
His boss
too.
Man is in the Cadillac.
Yes.
But these chain stores has got one man going up and down these highways, and they don't help pay these highways in the street and pay for nothing in town.
Amen.
They're out of these chain stores.
The chain store sermon was a phenomenal story. As you can hear in the sermon, it's a two-part sermon. One is where Reverend Gates is kind of bringing up the issue, and his congregation is speaking back to him about chain stores and what chain stores have done to them. It's a great, great, great example of some of the broader debates that are going on. As an advertisement that I have in the book, from the Business Week about complaints in 1930 about what the rise of chain stores in America had done. Many people sort of traced some of the downfall or the what happened with the Great Depression. They blamed it there at the doorstep of chain stores. So Reverend Gates takes this issue that's going on, that's spreading in America. It's in Business Week. It's in the Harvard Business Journal. It's a huge issue as chain stores such as A&P, Montgomery Ward, and others, Sears, begin to dominate the consumer landscape as opposed to small mom-and-pop stores. He takes these concerns, both how chain stores are affecting local economies, how local infrastructure is being destroyed. He also takes concerns about how it's affecting small businesses in the area. Members of his congregation play the role of working for small businesses or working as domestics, and how chain stores have moved into the community in Atlanta and have decimated jobs, sort of a trickle-down effect, if you will, but not in a good way. And Reverend Gates tries to preach a sermon about this, a two-part sermon about this. It's almost as if Reverend Gates had read some of the reports from the Federal Trade Commission and others about the concerns churches across the country were raising about chain stores in terms of its effect upon religious giving, local mom-and-pop stores, people who own those stores, work in those stores, how it's affecting them to have these large, beautiful chain stores being built in their communities. So he preaches the sermon, and then on part two, he has a small quartet basically put the sermon in song form, which would have been a popular a cappella style of singing, which would have been popular in churches, particularly Baptist churches, where things like piano and drums and trumpets were not welcomed at the time. And the interesting thing about this is that he records the sermon for OK Records in 1930. He records several other sermons that day in his in the studio session. And they release, they release and sell every single sermon that he records that day, except for the chain store sermon.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of Reverend Gates's sermons were being sold in chain stores. So I tried to use this sort of chapter to explain about how phonograph religion and commodifying the gospel, both then and now, certainly has its possibilities in terms of getting the message out to a broader community, lifting the profile of the gospel, getting it in the consumer marketplace where we know that people are. But it also has its limits in the sense of how capitalism and how corporate interests could actually shape the kinds of sermons that we hear and are bought in the marketplace, and maybe even more importantly, the kinds of sermons that we'll never hear in the marketplace because of the influence of corporate capitalism.
Yeah, there's an interesting tension there, too. You're preaching against the chain stores, but that's the medium in many ways you're embracing to get your message out. So it's just absolutely fascinating. Again, like, you know, you thought that jazz records were creating all this sinful behavior. So what do? You embrace that record industry and you know, go with it there. And people are buying both jazz records and these sermons. So
that's right.
Really interesting there. Now, we played clip number one from there. So if folks want to hear clip number two, we're going to point you back to our website where there'll be links to it on YouTube and other places. I want to kind of finish off with a couple questions here as we close up. What was the broader impact of this movement? So the phonograph religion era lasts roughly from the middle part of the 1920s into the 1940s, maybe early 50s. What is the lasting impact that this phenomena had?
I think a couple of things. I'll say first, I think it really normalizes this idea of buying sermons in the marketplace, that a sermon is something that is a commodity that can be purchased. Now, of course, we know that preachers had been publishing their sermons in terms of book form and others for centuries in America. But I think in terms of actually hearing a sermon, experiencing a sermon, sort of audibly what that experience is, I think it really pushed into the forefront this idea and the practice in American culture that the sermon is something that can be heard in any place and any time outside of the confines of the church, and it can be heard on demand, and it can be purchased. So I think it really began to turn America's sort of religious experience even more so to the marketplace than even published sermons did. I think the second thing it did is that it brings about a sort of two different sort of traditions I think we see in terms of religious authority, one in which is still very much so through education, through the charisma of office in terms of just pursuing denominational leadership, or whether it be pursuing leadership in parachurch organizations, or through education, through seminaries and divinity schools. And I think the other thing that we can trace back to this moment is the rise where preachers are trying to maintain a certain form of cultural authority by using the marketplace and using popularity, popular cultural authority, and cultural production, basing their authority on the fact that they produce popular commodities. And finally, I think third, I'll just say that I think to bring it back to the chain store sermon is just to think about how phonograph religion, again, selling sermons in the marketplace, it helps us to really see, I think, the effect upon the effect of corporate capitalism upon sermons and the religious discourse we hear in the marketplace. Producers of content are more, distributors of content are more concerned about making a profit, and as opposed to what's going to sell. As opposed to what's more true to the gospel, their main concern is what's going to sell. And I think that, and preachers also, right, if they're going to be popular, if they're going to have their sermons, their books in marketplaces, they've got to think about what's going to sell. And I think that preaching on wax teaches us, I think that we have to always be mindful of that. And while joining with popular trends, particularly in the marketplace, certainly has its possibilities, but I think it also invites us to think about its limits as well.
One final question here, and I always love to ask this of my guests because it's a somewhat of an academic personal reflection. You've been studying this for a while now and started back many, many years ago. Where are you at now? Is there anything through the course of your research on this and talking to different people and listening to all these records that really surprised you or changed your mind about something?
It did, Tony. I have to admit that I actually came out liking these preachers more than I thought I would. I think that because of the sort of fame and wealth, there's a chapter in the book about, for example, Reverend Gates and the kind of money he was able to make and the car he was able to buy and the kind of celebrity status that he rose to. I think that I did not expect that I was going to end the book with liking these individuals. I think that I was a little expecting myself to say, oh, this was just, these guys were completely being controlled by the marketplace and they were only concerned about making money. And the chain store sermon and other sermons, I think, showed me that these individuals found themselves in a very interesting moment in the midst of modern America, and they saw the phonograph industry as one way to carve out a place for themselves and their gospel. And I think that I was surprised at how much I've grown to like these individuals. Even as there still is a critique to be made, I think that I found myself surprisingly sympathetic to my historical actors after writing the book.
Yeah, it's always an amazing journey when you do that. You see the complexity of human beings that sometimes from a distance we see them as one-dimensional characters, but they really are multidimensional, and it's really kind of neat discovering that. And as you use that term, growing, scholarship and growing is things that we like to do, and one of the things we like to highlight here on Research on Religion. We know that you're writing a manuscript on the work of religious broadcasters and their relationship to the FBI. I'm sure that's in progress now, and we're going to have to check back with you on that because I'm betting that is going to be equally as fascinating as what you've just done. So please wait for our call on that. We'll be sure to get you back on the show again. My guest today has been Lerone Martin. Dr. Martin, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you so much, Tony. It was my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.